Soil is a vital living ecosystem that supports plants, animals, and humans. It's teeming with billions of bacteria, fungi, and other microbes that are the foundation of a complex ecosystem. Viewing soil this way reflects a fundamental shift in the way we care for it.
Today on the podcast, we're talking with Dr. David Montgomery of the University of Washington. Welcome to the show, David.
Sure. You know, when as a geologist, when I think about sort of the history of agriculture, well, that first thing that comes to my mind is, you know, what happened to the human diet coming out of the last ice age into the modern world that we know today, a period of time geologists call the Holocene. And you know, there were huge changes, not only in the climate and the sort of the geography of ice on this planet as the glaciers melted off, but the human diet really changed. And when I was researching Dirt, the first book that I wrote on soil-related stuff, I came across the idea that the human diet at the end of the last ice age started to change and move into the agricultural arena with the dawn of agriculture, not because somebody sat down and thought, hey, wouldn't it be great if we could plant a bunch of plants and then grow them here and harvest them. The agriculture in several regions around the world developed out of desperation. As the climate was changing and the plants and animals that were in the areas that people were living, particularly in the Near East and areas that's now in modern Iraq and the uplands, the Zagros Mountains, people ran out of food to eat. Basically, what they were used to hunting and gathering disappeared right out from under them. And there are studies that have shown that over time, people came to rely more on grains because that's what could still grow there. And once they figured out how to essentially really harvest large, husband and harvest large amounts of grains and survive on them, they were actually able to feed more people. And that was sort of the agriculture got off and running. And the more people they were able to feed with the higher calorie count that you can get from a grain-rich diet, fewer people were able to support more people, and that really sort of helped lead to the rise of more complex civilizations where you could have things like governments and priests and people who were not actually farmers. So back in those days, you know, almost everybody was a farmer growing the food that they needed to eat and their family needed to eat, whereas today we're down to 1-2% of the population is feeding the rest of us as farmers. So the really initial change in the post-Ice Age world was the adoption of agriculture and a shifting in the diet from the human diet from a diverse diet of found and foraged and hunted foods that were phytochemically rich, that were very diverse, and that had a whole different fat profile than we eat today, really came out of the end of the last ice age. And then as people adopted agriculture and became very proficient at growing grains, agriculture took root and helped drive the rise of civilizations around the world. But it also fundamentally changed our diet so that we were starting to eat more and more grains. Domesticated livestock, so certain kinds of meat and dairy became much more prevalent in the diets of people in different regions of the world, and that's reflected in our genomes. People in regions where we adopted animal husbandry and dairy and dairy production, people in those regions have a greater ability to digest lactose, the primary sugar in dairy products. And over time, agriculture then started to evolve as people noticed that the maintaining the fertility of the soil in agricultural fields became central to maintaining the continuity of feeding the public in those areas. Ideas of soil husbandry developed in different regions around the world. Things like planting legumes in crop rotations and diversifying crops and cover crops. Those are all sort of modern ideas that are coming back to the forefront of discussions about agriculture, but they're very old ideas. And erosion, as I wrote about in Dirt, had a tremendous impact on many ancient societies, but I tend to view the development of agriculture as having gone through four major revolutions, and we've talked about the first two, the development of agriculture in the first place, and then also the rise of soil husbandry in terms of methods to try and preserve the fertility of the soil that became traditional methods in landscapes around the world, and the human diet evolved to reflect the crops that were grown in those combinations. And then the third agricultural revolution really kicked off in the 19th century with with the development of chemical fertilizers and mechanization, sort of the fruits of the sort of the modern revolution in terms of science and the ability to harness energy other than our own body power and animal power. When fossil fuels became able to fuel mechanized machinery, the ability to do intensive tillage and combine that with intensive chemical fertilization was really sort of the third agricultural revolution. And that had great impacts in terms of the kinds of food that we eat, the amount of food that we're able to harvest. It actually helped support the continuing rise of the human population. And then the fourth agricultural revolution that I like to recognize was the revolution in the biotech revolution, starting with the Green Revolution and fertilizer-intensive crop development through crop breeding in the 1940s and 50s. That also, I tend to lump the modern sort of biotech revolution in terms of GMO crops and applications and modern herbicides and that kind of stuff into a fourth agricultural revolution. And that helped sort of cement major commodity crops as the foundation of the human diet in the westernized world and increasingly globally. And that changed the mix of what we eat. We now eat a much less diverse diet that is that has fewer phytochemicals, fewer mineral micronutrients, less fiber, and more calories. And so the basic mix of the human diet shifted in the 20th century. And I like to think that we're on the cusp of a fifth agricultural revolution, one that would be rooted in the concepts of soil health and regenerative agriculture, that can help reverse some of the damage that conventional methods have done over the last couple centuries to soils around the world, and put more organic matter back in soils, and also enhance the nutrient density of our crops, and put more phytochemicals back in our diet, put more mineral micronutrients back in our diet, and depending on what we actually feed our livestock, actually put more omega-3 fats back in our diet, which were very limited, very reduced in the diet of our livestock after the Second World War, when we started feeding livestock more on grains than on actively grazing diverse pastures. That completely changed the fat profile in our meat and dairy products, and even in our eggs. And so the human diet has changed as a result, sort of following the changes in agriculture through history. The human diet has followed along with it. And we're now learning enough about the impacts of those changes on the health of the land, on soil health, and also on human health in terms of the rise of chronic diseases and the reduction in the nutrient density of our food, that it's, you know, we're starting to take a new look at the history of agriculture and the future of agriculture and the future of food through the lens of how we treat the soil affecting how the land in turn can treat us through what we harvest. Yeah, it's fascinating how if you look at the sort of the changes with the adoption of what we now call modern conventional agricultural techniques, in hindsight, we're learning that it resulted in a reduction of the mineral micronutrient density in our crops and in our livestock. It resulted in a complete shift in the fat profile of our meat and dairy products that we tend to get conventionally. And it also resulted in a great diminution of the amount of phytochemicals, plant-made chemicals, compounds plants make for their own defensive purposes, but that it turns out actually have a major role in human health as well, in terms of being very powerful antioxidants and anti-inflammatories. And when we look at the kind of compounds that have been reduced inadvertently in our diet in the last century, it maps right onto the kind of things that our bodies actually could use to help quell inflammation and to help quell oxidation, antioxidants and anti-inflammatories. And increasingly, medical science is revealing that the root of many human ailments that have become more prevalent in the last 100 years, cancer, autoimmune conditions, and so forth, are rooted in inflammation. And so it's a very serious question as to how much of the modern rise in chronic diseases is due to reducing in our diet the kinds of compounds that once were much more abundant before those kinds of conditions were so prevalent in modern society. And of course, connecting those kind of dots is complicated because, you know, each of our diets is different, our genetics are different, the way different farmers treat their land is different, and different kind of crop varieties have really different levels of, naturally have really different levels of mineral micronutrients and produce different levels of phytochemicals. So it's a complex kind of question to get your mind around, but the general outlines of it are pretty clear that when we adopted what we now call modern conventional agriculture, sort of agrochemically intensive, tillage intensive monocultures for the most part, or functional monocultures with just a couple crops, we shortchanged our own diet in ways that we didn't anticipate. And so sort of what went wrong? We didn't understand and recognize the kinds of connections we do today between the microbial world, the bacteria and fungi in the soil, the life in the soil, and how that actually helps crops take up mineral micronutrients from the soil, and how it stimulates them to create, to make the phytochemicals that they use for their own purposes, and that our bodies evolved when we were eating plants that were rich in a lot of them, to essentially use for our own purposes. So in a way, science has been catching up with some traditional insights in terms of what to grow and how to grow it, but connecting the dots in terms of how the way we treat the land impacts the microbial world, what Ann and I called the hidden half of nature in our book with the same title. So in a way, I've been on a journey for the last 10 years learning about how the connections between the way we treat the land not only can degrade soil and impact civilizations over, you know, century timescales, but what that means for what's actually in the food we eat on a day-to-day basis. And there's, I think, a new era of dawning awareness about those connections in terms of how the way we grow our food translates into not only the health of the land, but helps set what you might consider the preventive medicine content of the food that we eat. We've been essentially running an uncontrolled experiment on ourselves at a population level for the last 100 years by shifting our diet in this way. And, you know, if you look at, one of the reasons that people are kind of hardwired, I think, to really sort of love sugar and salt is that they were pretty rare in our ancestral diet. So, you know, when you found them, you wanted to eat them because sugar is a great energy source. You know, it doesn't bring much more than energy, but it's a great energy source. And, you know, our taste buds are just set to love sugar. And salt's the same way. You know, we need salt to survive, but we don't need as much as we're eating today on average. But our taste buds are just set to love that combination. And, you know, and I'm as guilty as anyone of loving that combination. But, you know, with our genetic variability between people and with the change in our diet, eating a whole lot of things that used to be rare can have different impacts on us. And so today we're eating far less fiber, which turns out to be very good. I mean, a lot of fiber is really good for our microbiome. We essentially evolved from frugivores that ate sort of fallen fruit in the forest to animals that, you know, once we got the ability to cook, we could eat more tubers and root crops. We could eat more meat and break that down so it was digestible with cooking. And then we evolved, we transitioned to eating more grains in the agricultural era. And then in the modern era, we've started to eating far more grains and far less of a diverse set of foods that had more in the way of fiber and less in the way of sugar and less in the way of salt. So today we're essentially in the processed food era. We've re-engineered food to basically be very tasty, but not as nutritious. And so, like, if you look at what we do to wheat, for example, in terms of breaking the grain of wheat down into white flour, we're basically stripping all the minerals out, we're stripping all the phytochemicals out, we're stripping all the vitamins out, because that's in the bran that basically gets stripped out, so that we're just eating the energy source that the seed provided to help the plant grow, rather than all the nutritional elements that the seed was providing to help it get a kickstart. And one of the interesting things that I've learned in the last few years about sort of the way seeds work is that some of the initial carbon that a growing plant will take out, will take from the atmosphere, they're put a disproportionate amount of that back into the soil as root exudates with sort of the young growing plant. And you might think that, well, you know, growing from a tiny seed, the first carbon a plant captures is going to go towards building its body bigger so it can capture more sunlight and keep growing, right? I mean, that's what would make sense.
Yeah.
But a lot of it, a disproportionate amount, is going out through the roots into the soil, which makes no sense at all unless you think about, well, why would a plant do that? And it's to foster the right kind of microbes in the soil that will help that plant grow. And plants are putting out very specific microbes into the soil to recruit very particular fungal and bacterial partners to help that plant grow. And that's how the plant will get a lot of its mineral micronutrients, by recruiting the right partners, because roots only go so far, but fungal hyphae, I mean, you know, a fistful of hyphae has like miles and miles, a fistful of soil has miles and miles of hyphae. So plants are recruiting partners in the soil, and that's had an impact on what it is that we eat, as we've changed farming's relationship to soil health and soil fertility from one in which we're essentially cultivating beneficial life in the soil to build fertility, to one in which we're adding chemical ingredients to provide what we need to grow higher harvests, but not necessarily harvests that are as nutrient dense as they once were. So those connections are quite real, and the impacts on human health are, I think we're just starting to realize how much that change in our diet has meant. And most of us probably recognize more that the food processing, in terms of, you know, stripping out the minerals and vitamins from grains to make white flour, you know, that had an impact on what gets into our bodies. But the way that we actually grow our other crops had comparable impacts. And so when you look at sort of the net effect of modern farming practices, shall we say, or modern conventional farming practices on the human diet, it's sort of changed through not just how we process food, but how we're growing it. The whole history of food processing is really interesting, where if you look back in the 19th century, you know, it's, why did people start going for white flour and white rice, for example? That's something that Ann and I looked into with the new book that we'll have coming out spring 2022 called What Your Food Ate, when we look at the kind of issues that we're talking about here. You know, a lot of the impetus and drive for going to white rice and white flour didn't come necessarily because people thought it tasted better, or, you know, really wanted that initially. It was because it shipped better and it stored better. There were, you know, non-nutritional concerns that really helped drive that. And why is that? Because when you look at like a grain, the part that ends up left after processing is really the sugar starch-rich energy component. The part that had all the fats and the minerals and stuff in it, that's the part that starts to go rancid first. Because, you know, fats will be the thing in a grain that starts to decay first once the seed is dead, or if it sits around for too long. They're not as stable as the starch and sugar. And so people, you know, commercial interests who are, you know, shipping grains around Asia, or shipping wheat in Europe, really liked the idea of processing the grain to remove the bran and the germ and just keep the endosperm, get rid of all the minerals and vitamins and the fats and just keep the sugar. Because it shipped better, it stored better, it was better for the middlemen. It wasn't necessarily better for the consumer. And so we've traced a lot of concerns about the nutritional impact of food processing back to, you know, people in the 20s and 30s were doing experiments on rats and pigeons and things, basically showing that if you fed them essentially the processed grains, they had horrible health problems, whereas if you fed them the whole grains, the problems cleared right up. So in processing so intensively, starting with grains, which is where food processing really started to kick off in the Western world, we stripped, you know, nutritionally valuable components out of our diet in the name of other things, shipping, storage. And it wasn't even about calorie production, because we were taking calories out of food to process them. And ironically, we were doing things like feeding the germ and the bran of grains to livestock rather than eating it ourselves. And when food processing really became a high art, shall we say, in the 1950s, 60s, and later, it cemented a system of taking what were whole foods and breaking them into individual constituents, and then, you know, mixing and matching and throwing parts of them away for other purposes, and then putting them back together. And that's where the whole flavoring industry sort of evolved, in terms of how to make those reconstituted foods not only palatable, but seductive and irresistible, like Doritos. I can't resist them, right? But they're not necessarily the best food nutritionally. They're great for calories and salt. But by changing our diet in ways that we then had far higher sugar intake and far higher salt intake, we really ran an experiment on our bodies. And the rise of diabetes, the rise of obesity, and the rise of, you know, of heart disease are all things that, you know, are not solely due to those dietary changes, but that those played a role, right?
Yeah.
And when you look at there's studies that have come out in the last 10 years looking at what happens when you eat essentially a whole food relative to stuff that, very simple sugars. The sugars are, there's two kinds of sugars. There's complex sugars and simple sugars. Complex sugars, complex carbohydrates, we know by the name fiber. The thing that my doctor always told me to eat more of for years that I never really knew what it was, right? It's this abstract concept. But it's basically, think of it as the parts of plants that are hard to digest. And simple sugars are the things that are in sodas. They're the things that are, that's a short sugar chain, a short carbohydrate chain that can readily get absorbed in your body. And so when we eat, say, a whole food that is fiber-rich, rich in complex carbohydrates relative to a candy bar, say, that's rich in simple sugars, they get absorbed differently by our bodies. The simple sugars get absorbed in the small intestine, sort of at the start of our digestive tract. The complex carbohydrates take longer to move through us, and they end up landing in our colon, our large intestine, the end stop on our digestive tract. And that's where an awful lot of biochemical magic happens in terms of our microbiome, the organisms that live within us, our endemic flora and fauna, or our endemic microbes, endemic bacteria and fungi for the most part. They feast on those complex carbohydrates, and they ferment it in our colon. And they turn those complex compounds into things that have medicinal effects in our bodies. Things like butyrate, which nourishes the lining of our colon walls. So a lot of irritable bowel syndrome, for example, can be traced to sort of inadequate provisioning of dietary fiber that results in inadequate provisioning of our colon lining, which then starts to be less healthy. So there's these connections in between sort of the style of what we eat and how our body sort of takes it up and treats it that track all the way over into health. And so the simplest way I like to think about it is that, when we're running on a high sugar and, by analogy, high salt diet, we're kind of running on rocket fuel. We're running our bodies hot and fast, and we're not designed to do that. I'm a VW. I'm not a Porsche. when you take whole foods that are complex mixes that are harder for our body to break down but that actually support our microbiome, we get kind of like a drip filtering of nutrients into it rather than a spike of fuel. And that has a big difference to how we perform. If we need a burst of energy, sure, a candy bar is a great way to get a quick burst of energy. But that's not, simple sugars aren't really the right way to keep your body running well over the long run. We need those antioxidants. We need those anti-inflammatories. We need the compounds that our microbiome makes from complex carbohydrates, from all that fiber. We need those things for the maintenance and upkeep of our bodies. They, in a very real sense, they help our cells clean house and get rid of the oxidation damage that results from our mitochondria, those little powerhouses in our cells that actually are our energy source. We need antioxidants to help reduce the waste products that they produce in our cells. And we need anti-inflammatories to help our bodies actually stand down after triggering the inflammation that can help us defeat, help us defeat pathogens that start to get into us. If you cut your finger in the kitchen, for example, and it turns red, it gets a little inflamed because your body is going to war with the things that are crawled off that knife and into your skin. But once they've defeated those organisms, we need inflammation to turn off and stand down. And one of the interesting things that we've learned that science has learned in the last couple decades is that inflammation isn't a simple process of it gets our immune system firing up a defense and then defeating the barbarians that have invaded our body and then dissipating and it's all over. Our bodies actively need to turn inflammation off. And we need anti-inflammatories, and in particular, omega-3 fats are really good ways for turning inflammation off because they help trigger the physiological cascade that gets our body's defense mechanisms to stand down and turn off. We all know that if you leave the stove on night and day for a month, it's a great way to burn your house down. I mean, you want the stove there to be able to boil tea or cook or something, but you don't leave it on full blast all the time. And that inflammation is the same in our bodies. We need it to basically defend ourselves, but we need to be able to turn it off. And a lot of the things that we've lost from our diet in the history of the last 100 years, through food processing and through changes in the way we grow our crops and raise our livestock, it's essentially reduced the availability to our bodies of the things our bodies rely on to actually turn inflammation off. And that's, again, that's something that Ann and I go into in What's Your Food Ate in some detail. So I'm talking a lot about it today because I've been working a lot on it in the last couple of years trying to understand the history of how that's evolved. And it's fascinating, and I think not well enough known. Every eater ought to know about the basic ways that, you know, what's in our food affects the ability of our bodies to maintain our health. Yeah, you know, we really are creatures of habit and creatures of instant gratification, which are, you know, might seem like sort of inconsistencies, but they're really just sort of, they're both part of who most of us are. We all have our habits that are hard to break, but the good thing about habits are that if you can change them, they become new habits, and you can carry them forward. And we do have a problem, I think, systematically in terms of addressing sort of long-running problems. We're much better at reacting to crises and immediate things and then going back to what we were doing before after we've solved those crises. And that applies in agriculture as well as in what we eat. But what, you know, Ann and I also found that we changed our diet up a lot in the last 5 years from researching the Hidden Half of Nature and What Your Food Ate. We used to think that we had a really great diet. You know, we live in Seattle. There's a lot of organic food. You can buy, you know, vegan organic donuts in Seattle, right? I mean, there's all kinds of things where you might think that would sort of lead to a healthier diet. What we sort of realized is that we were eating the wrong mix of things and that we were not paying enough attention to sort of how it was grown. I used to be on a whole bunch of prescription medications for, you know, high blood pressure, acid reflux, and by changing my diet, I've essentially gotten off all those medications. And my doctor was saying, well, what did you do? And I was like, well, you know, I'm eating differently. And so what did we decide to do? Well, Ann and I are omnivores. We eat everything. So I didn't adopt some specialty diet. What Ann and I both did, and I should give Ann credit as being the impetus for the primary movement behind our shifting of our diet, but our new diet's now become kind of a habit for me. So what did we do? We started making sure that we were eating enough plant foods, enough whole plant foods to feed our microbiome. And that means, you know, like, yeah, I'll have a salad with dinner. Yeah, we eat vegetables with dinner. We also started rethinking, you know, what kind of meat that we buy. So we're essentially much more, we're buying grass-fed beef. We're buying regeneratively grazed animals. Why? Because that gives us and we're buying grass milk and grass milk based cheeses, because that gives a higher omega-3 to omega-6 fat ratio. And why is that important? The briefest view of that is the omega-3 fats tend to be anti-inflammatory, omega-6 fats tend to be pro-inflammatory. And the ratio of those in your diet is important because you want your body to be able to do both, turn inflammation on, turn inflammation off. And as part of the change in the way we grow our food and process foods in the 20th century, we increased our omega-6 content of our diet by 20-fold or something and decreased the omega-3 content. So, and why is that? Because seeds put on omega-6s, because they're basically, it's a storage fat, leafy greens tend to have a lot of omega-3s. Why? Because chloroplasts, you know, the organelles that are involved in photosynthesis, they use a lot of omega-3s. It's a very dynamic, chemically reactive molecule. So a cow that grazed grass is eating a whole lot of omega-3s, whereas a cow that grazed on seed-derived, you know, corn-derived products, is eating a whole lot of omega-6s. So that was one of the elements we changed in our diet, was, you know, changing the fat profile and made sure that we're eating an abundance of, you know, whole plant foods. And those are sort of the two big changes that we made. And they had a huge impact on our health, as Ann and I have seen over the last few years, in terms of, you know, not curing us of anything, but basically helping to dampen down the kinds of trajectories that we are on in terms of developing problems that would become that are very common later in life now. And so we were that was sort of the proof in the pudding to us in terms of, oh, we were thinking about our diet wrong. We need to think about, you know, how we raise our crops. We need to think about how we raise our livestock. And we need to think about the mix of whole and processed foods that we eat. And so I've been eating far less sugar and far less salt. But I still eat both. I just changed the mix and the balance, right? And it's almost trite to say that moderation is the key to good whatever one's talking about. But in the case of diet, we really, in the 20th century, overdid it on the salt and the fat, and we overdid it on the salt and the sugar, excuse me, and we overdid it on the omega-6 fats. And we can dial that back. And I think that you can make a very good case for looking at how we grow our food and the mix of foods that we eat as being the foundation for good health. Today, we're essentially very well fed on average in the developed world, but we're relatively undernourished. So we got plenty of calories, but we're not getting the right mix of stuff to help our bodies run well. And, you know, Anne hates this analogy, so I don't think we used it in the new book, but I tend to look at, you know, food and the relationship between food and our body kind of the way you look at, like, you know, maybe like maintaining your car. If you never change your oil and you never put oil in the engine, you're going to run into trouble. You're going to run your car down. Maintenance is essential to keeping a machine working. And we're biological machines. We're sort of more than a machine, but in a way we're biochemical machines. And a lot of the changes in our diet that we've seen historically and very recently are things that sort of undercut the maintenance and the keeping our bodies running smoothly. And that's where, you know, problems can develop in terms of systemic problems that may manifest differently in different people, and that different people may be susceptible to at different levels and susceptible to different aspects of it in different ways. And, you know, and of course our lifestyle is going to play into that as well in terms of exercise and where we live and, you know, whether you live in a place like Seattle where none of us get enough vitamin D because the sun's never out. Sure, I think we're at a pivotal point in terms of agriculture's relationship to the soil, to put it simply. If you look back at the history of civilizations, that practices that relied overly on tillage, on the plow, degraded soils in society after society. And that's how I really got into looking at, as a geologist, that's how I got into looking at soils, was through the loss of soils, soil erosion, and soil degradation. And you can put a serious case together that tillage essentially undermined, gradually, but systematically and progressively, undermined civilization after civilization around the world. And why? Well, because tillage helps to oxidize soil organic matter. It stimulates bacterial activity that helps to really degrade soil organic matter. And that's essentially the batteries that run soil fertility in a natural system. So over time, you know, the Romans and the Greeks and the people and people in various societies around the world undermine the fertility of their land through their farming practices, even though they started to recognize the importance of legumes and cover crops or rotations. If they continually tilled it, they were just delaying the decline. And there's a great literature that goes back centuries on that, even in the English language. And if you look today at how you might turn that around and reverse it, this is where I sort of became an optimist in visiting places like Minocan Farm while I was writing Growing a Revolution. The combination of, you know, of adopting no-till practices and integrating that with cover crops and a diverse rotations, and even bringing livestock and reintegrating livestock management, regenerative livestock management into crop production, are ways to actually cultivate the beneficial life in the soil, enhance soil organic matter, and rebuild the fertility of agricultural land. And that combination of three things, the sort of the no-till, the cover crops, and the diversity, when you think about why would those work? Well, because you're not disturbing soil life. You're not chopping up all the mycorrhizal hyphae when you go to no-till. You're feeding it with organic matter via the cover crops, and the root exudates that you get from a diverse community of crops actually feeds a diverse community of soil life, which gives plants a diversity of partners to work with in the soil. So that combination is about cultivating beneficial life in the soil. It's also, you know, grossly the opposite of what we tried to do with modern conventional agriculture, where we went with intensive tillage, a lot of agrochemical use, and a preference for growing, you know, one or two crops. And so it's a real different way to look at the land. And one of the reasons, I think, in looking back at the history of the adoption of what we now call conventional farming practices, is that part of what set the stage for their growing popularity in the late 19th and early 20th century was that farmland in Western Europe and Eastern North America had already been degraded through centuries of tillage. And that meant that if you could come in with a chemical fertilizer and enhance your yields and get yields like your grandparents or great-grandparents had achieved, that was kind of a miracle. But it came at an unrecognized cost at the time in terms of changes in how that plant, those crops, interacted with the soil and how that impacted what then ended up in our food. So I think we're at a pivotal point where we've now, the science has come far enough that we can see the connections between soil health and the health of crops and how that can translate into helping to support human health or not. And so I see our relationship with the soil through agriculture at a potential pivotal point where we can either continue practices that degrade the soil and try and artificially maintain its fertility, but continuing it with what's now called conventional agriculture, or we can shift to a more regenerative style of farming that takes, you know, some of the ancient wisdom of things like cover crops and crop rotations and combines it with the modern technology that allows us to do that with no-till, and get a whole new system of farming working that is, you know, is loosely called regenerative agriculture. That could set us on a whole new trajectory where we could actually rebuild rather than degrade soil as a consequence of farming. And that'd be a sea change, because for the last 10,000 years, we've basically been degrading the land to feed ourselves. That can only go on for so long and to feed so many. And at the moment, you know, we have a planet that's getting pretty darn full of people. There's not a lot of extra soil around. And we need to basically maintain its fertility. And beyond that, I would argue, we need to rebuild its fertility. And the way to do that is through a new style of agriculture, through more of a regenerative agriculture. No, and change, you know, if you look at, one of the things that humanity is actually, in the end, really good at is change. We may resist it on a daily basis. We may hate it when it makes us change our habits and our practices. We may not want to hear about it because it makes our life more complicated. But over the long run, that's how we've overrun this planet with our numbers. We've adapted to almost everywhere in this world. You know, what other organism has done that? We're incredibly adaptive, and the essence of that adaptation is, you know, dealing with change and changing the way we do things. And I think if we're going to maintain agriculture over the long run on this planet, we're going to have to shift it through this, what I hope is this unfolding soil health revolution. We're going to have to shift the way we treat the land for growing our food. But I've gone from being, you know, sort of a pessimist when I wrote Dirt and sort of realizing that, oh my, you know, we've destroyed how much of the world's farmland already, to starting to think that, wow, we could actually turn this around. I may not live long enough to see the whole turnaround, but the trajectory is starting to look better and better on the agricultural end. We still have issues with climate change and a bunch of other things we have to deal with as a society. But I think we're starting to recognize that there's a path, as you put it, that there's a path forward that is not only feasible, it's attractive. It can result in more profitable farms. If you spend less on agrochemicals and you spend less on diesel, but you harvest just as much, you're going to be a more profitable farmer. And that's one of the lessons I learned researching Growing a Revolution, is how effective that can be for the farmers. And that started getting me into more of an optimistic view of the future. Because, you know, for farming to be sustainable, we have to sustain not just the land or the soil, we have to sustain the farms and the act of farming and the lifestyle of farming as a livelihood. And I see regenerative agriculture as a path to putting new energy into that and a new viability in terms of family farms across the country and around the world. So, yeah, I think there's cause for cautious optimism here, which is actually a wonderful emotion to be entertaining. Yeah, it's challenging. I think you're right about that. And I think there's also additional effects that it can be challenging to find food that's grown, to actually have access to the kind of food one might want to shift to. Like in inner cities, for example, just the provisioning of fresh vegetables is difficult because you walk into the stores and there aren't any in some areas. Anne and I went on a, for part of our new book, we went on a shopping trip at different region areas around Seattle, sort of looking for what we could buy. And when we went to the zip code in town that has the lowest mean annual income, you know, the only stores we could find are like neighborhood corner markets that were selling liquors and cigarettes and packet and processed food. You literally could not buy fresh produce without leaving that zip code. And that was, you know, so there's our habits and the way that we're acculturated to want certain things and to think of certain things as food. And, you know, and as evidence of how variable that can be, just look at all the different cuisines around the world. You know, someone somewhere everywhere in the world thinks that's their normal cuisine, even if we may consider it exotic because we didn't grow up with it. So there's our personal preferences and our choices, but there's also just the access to it. And, you know, one of the sobering statistics I read in researching the new book was looking at how if everyone in the United States was to eat the USDA recommended servings of fruits and vegetables every day, we don't produce them anywhere near enough to actually satisfy the demand. So it would be actually impossible for everyone in the U.S. to simply follow the existing governmental recommendations on what to eat. So one can argue plenty about the nature of those dietary guidelines, but if you just accept them at face value, we don't grow the food that it would take to feed that diet to everybody. So there's some structural problems as well, and I view part of that as if we think about the symbiosis between eaters and farmers. You know, if eaters want to eat a more diverse diet, we need farmers to grow a greater diversity of crops, but they have to be able to sell those crops to be able to keep farming, so which means you can't just, they have to change simultaneously. So it's going to be sort of a process of evolution, the next stage in the evolution of our diet. You know, and will we go towards a healthier diet of more fiber-rich, diverse crops and omega-3-rich meat and dairy, or are we going to go down the route of essentially resynthesized and processed plant foods that are rich in omega-6s and salt and sugar, but don't provide some of the other things our body needs? We're at a pivotal point in our diet, in our dietary future, and in the future of farming. And you put those two together, and it's the arc of the future of food. It, you know, it remains for us to determine what that will be. Yeah, we do a similar thing in terms of we've gotten into the habit of trying to buy as much as we can from farmers at the local farmers markets who we kind of know how they grow their food. And so we've kind of like, you know, figured out who our favorite farmers for certain crops are. But you know, we're not able to buy everything at a farmer's market, so we'll go to stores as well. The big change, I guess, philosophically in the way that Anne and I have moved to buying our food is we've moved from thinking that, you know, organic is good enough, that if we buy organic, that's going to be, you know, fine, to thinking that, no, let's think about the mix of things. Let's think about how they all go together. And some of the farms that we buy stuff from are not organic, but we like the way they farm. They're farmers who are taking care of their land, and yes, the food seems to be, you know, rich in the kinds of phytochemicals that tend to impart good flavor. I mean, one of the things we've learned in writing What Your Food Ate, as it's going to be called, is that the roots of flavor in many whole foods actually are in those compounds that we've systematically, and though inadvertently, stripped out of our modern diet. The things like phytochemicals, the things like omega-3 fats, those kind of things are actually compounds that flavors of food are often, of whole foods, often are derived from the degradation of those products. So the flavors are advertising that the food is actually rich in them. And so, you know, one of the other optimistic ends of all this thing is that, well, actually, we might be able to eat tastier food, maybe healthier food. But of course, the difference is, like, if it's a processed food that's been engineered to have a flavor, that link between health and flavor is broken. But in whole foods, from what we can tell, that link is fairly strong in whole foods. So there's kind of a different way to think about flavor when we're thinking about how our food was actually made or grown. So, yeah, we're excited about the new book and the way that it all came together. I sort of view it as as a capstone on Dirt, the Hidden Half, and Growing Revolution, and trying to connect that whole arc of how we've treated the land and the way microbes affect food and the way farmers can turn the story around. The next piece of it is, what does it mean for our health and the food that we eat? And that's where literally it's the final version's off to the publisher this week. Yeah, pardon the pun, but I see growing interest in regenerative agriculture and in the way, in people wanting to know how their food was grown. I see that as a parallel with interest in the farming communities in soil health, which, 20, 30 years ago, how many people were really talking about that as a concept? It was kind of crazy talk. And now it's like, oh, wait, that's how it actually works. And I think we may be seeing that starting to take root. Sorry about the second pun. In terms of consumer awareness and how people are thinking about their food, and wanting to know, what is the connection, and not just because that they're, interested in for some abstract reason, but because they increasingly think it actually matters to what that food's going to be doing for them.
The Soil Health Podcast is a production of the Minokin Farm. Minokin Farm exists to foster natural resource education and systems approach conservation. This 150-acre demonstration farm, located just east of Bismarck, North Dakota, was established in 2009 and draws people from all over the world. The farm is owned and operated by Burley County Soil Conservation District, which has an office in Bismarck, North Dakota. Additional financial and technical support is provided by the North Dakota Department of Health Water Quality Division, Natural Resources Conservation Service, and the U.S. Department of Agriculture.